We're beginning in the book of Shmuel, and being that it's a new semester, we're going to introduce what we're learning. In this class, we tried to cover the Tanakh as quickly as possible, time to, and we're about to enter such a topic that requires more depth, and without depth, I don't know if there's any point in learning this specific topic. But our general goal here is to cover as much ground as possible with a basic understanding so that if someone goes through this class, he'll have a basic picture of Tanakh. That being said, we'll remind ourselves of where we're holding in Jewish history. So we'll begin with the beginning. God creates the world. 6 days, 7th day, God rests. 10 generations later, we have Noah. The Jewish people have evolved. And they've developed many, many negative traits. And so God destroys the world. There's a flood. Noah is saved. He has 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet. The chosen one is Shem. 10 generations later, from Shem emanates Abraham, the light unto the world. Avraham ha'ivri. Abraham was on the other side of the world. When God created the world, before God created the world, there was the notion that there would be the three forefathers. The three forefathers, they brought down into the world concepts that are the foundation of creation. We know Avram was Chesed, Yitzchak was Yira, Avoda. Yaakov represented a certain wholeness, the Am Yisrael. The three forefathers represent 3 legs to God's throne, 3 legs to the chair. And most thrones need a fourth chair. In order to be stable. Well, we have the three forefathers, and Yaakov has 12 tribes, and the Jews go down to Egypt. They come out of Egypt, God brings them to Sinai. Short time later, they sin and they serve a golden calf. God says he will destroy the Jewish people and resurrect them through Moshe. And Moshe says, well, if a chair that has 3 legs couldn't stand, then how can a chair that has 1 leg stand? In other words, Moshe was going to represent the 4th leg of the throne. There are different strengths in this world, and Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov each brought down certain strengths and acquired certain important traits that would be a part of the Jewish people. And Moshe, in standing up for the Jewish people and in receiving the Torah, is about to acquire the 4th leg to the throne, it would seem. And God tells him, I'll destroy the Jewish people and start from you. And God is basically saying, we'll begin with everything you have. And Moshe is saying, wait a second. If the other 3 legs aren't enough to maintain this chair, then how's the world going to be sustained on me? 1 leg can't do that. And Moshe argues, and he saves the Jewish people, and the Jewish people are not wiped out after they serve the golden calf. The Jewish people enter the land of Israel 40 years later, and we have the period of the judges after each judge dies, so there's a period of disarray. There's some turmoil, the people again start serving idols, and God sends a judge to teach them and to rebuke them. And after falling prey to enemy after enemy, the Jews always repent when the judge comes and tells them, hey, if you want God to save you. So each day they start sinning, and God, sends an enemy to overtake them. The enemy overtakes them, and they repent. God helps them repent, and the cycle continues. The judge dies, they go back down again they're overtaken by a nation. Until finally, the Jews have had enough, and they say, we want a king, a continuum, a dynasty. And God appoints our first continuum, a dynasty. And God appoints our first king, King Saul. King Saul errs in his kingdom. And had he not erred, he would have been the first Messiah that is, so to speak, the son of Yosef. He has one job within the Jewish people. And then a Messiah, the son of David, that has another job within the Jewish people. So Mashiach, King Saul could have been Mashiach ben Yosef, and King David could have been the next Messiah. But King Saul erred. He did not wipe out Amalek the way he should have. And so his dynasty was not to continue, and it was passed over to David, who took the throne. Yeah?
I'm convinced who Mashiach ben Yosef was.
Okay. But don't tell anyone.
What do you mean?
Shh. So the
Rav Meir Kahana.
So
I said it.
The halacha says,
sorry,
you don't smack a kid once he reaches a certain age, because he'll hit you back. And you're not supposed to set someone up to do something they shouldn't have done. If I thought you would have said it, I wouldn't have thought you're not. Sorry. I didn't know I was setting you up. I didn't know. Okay, back to our to our Jewish history.
Same subject.
Yeah, okay, fine. So anyways, David takes the throne. And David is really King Saul's son-in-law. After a period where King Saul, recognizing the threat that David represents, has chased and tried to kill David, his son-in-law, and has been unsuccessful, ultimately King Saul and his sons die at battle. And one of King Saul's sons takes the throne, and he fights a few battles with King David and his men. And finally, when he dies, he's assassinated. Then King David takes the throne over all of the Jewish people. And where we left off was where King David had sent messengers to comfort the Amman, who had passed away, and the son had taken the throne. So the new king, the son, is being sent messengers from King David to comfort him. And the reason that King David does this act of kindness is because King David recalls an act of kindness that the Ammonite king who had passed away, the late king, had done to King David. And that was that when King David was on the run from his father-in-law, King Saul, so if you guys don't mind, I'm going to switch to Shaul HaMelech and David HaMelech instead of King David and King Saul. David HaMelech is King David and Shaul HaMelech is King Saul. So David remembered an act of kindness that the king of Ammon had done to him. When David was on the run from his father-in-law Shaul, so David had taken his family, his parents and siblings, and given them to the safekeeping of the Moabite king. And no sooner had David left the scene and the Moabite king killed all of them, one of them managed to escape. The Ammonite king had given him refuge. And so David remembered that the Ammonite king had given this one family member refuge by him. So when he passed away, David sent his men to comfort the king of Ammon. Now, the king of God wasn't happy with this. God said, I told you that when you pass near the land of Ammon, you don't ask them for peace, you don't greet them with warmth, you maintain a distance from Ammon and Moab. Ammon and Moab are problematic, greet them with warmth, you maintain a distance from Ammon and Moab. Ammon and Moab are problematic people. They come from inside. Ammon and Moab were born. They were impregnated, and then 9 months later they were born. Two children named Ammon and Moab from whom these people came. And God says that he is giving them their lands as lands of inheritance. God says the Jewish people can have the land of Israel, and the Ammonite people can have the land of Ammon, and the Moabite people can have the land of Moab. So Ammon and Moab are people that are going to be our nation, our neighbors for a while. And God says, don't have friendly relations with them. Don't go saying hi, how are our neighbors for a while. And God says, don't have friendly relations with them. Don't go saying hi, how are you, okay, making things very warm. I'm not interested in that. And so when David sends these messengers to comfort the king of Ammon, in heaven they're not happy with David. So they greet you with warmth, as they can't greet you with warmth. And David, you know, he keeps the Torah. If he's sending these, it must be that they're spying the land, and that's why they came up to the capital. So the king listens to their advice, and he shaves the people's beards and cuts their garments in half, and now they're half naked and half beard shaven, and he sends them home in disgrace. So David hears what the Ammonite king did, and David sends word to his old messengers. He tells them, wait, it's a disgrace, you don't have to be embarrassed to come back with your beards half shaven off, you don't have to be disgraced this way, so stay over there, and when your beards grow back, you'll come back. And David gathers his forces. He sends his men out to fight the people of Ammon. After what they've done, the people of Ammon recognize that they've erred, and they start hiring mercenaries, and they pay the neighboring nations to join them in a war against Israel. And we describe the first war, how they were able to trick us, and they were able to get us to approach the city, and we were attacked from front and behind. And Yoav divided the forces. He took a group of forces with him, and he sent a group of forces with his brother, and they had a war on two fronts, and they were victorious. But they have not yet concluded the war. They won the first battles, but they haven't finished the war. And now we're about to enter a story which is one of the most elaborate and complicated stories in Tanakh. One of the stories that is most misunderstood. And in order to correctly understand the story, we need to introduce the story and get an overview of the story and then understand the story with more depth. The Gemara recounts that there was an Amora who finished learning all of the Torah. He knew everything. And after a while, knowing everything, he bumped into someone who taught him a new rule. He said to him, "Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto." There's a concept that you can understand the verses literally. So he said, "Really? There exists such a concept that the verses have a literal explanation as well?" And from here we see that our approach to Tanakh is warped. The correct approach is first one has to work with tradition and get the background and understanding what the Pesukim are really telling us, because we're not just studying history here. This isn't a history book. This is Tanakh. This is the Bible that God gave us. This was said by prophets. There's a lot of history that isn't mentioned here because this isn't a history book. So in order to understand what's written here, we have to approach it as the sacred text that it is. It's the Word of God. So God isn't just telling us stories when God recounts the wars of David and the people around him. God is giving us a message that we're supposed to learn from for eternity. That's why this was written. There were many prophecies given. We have a tradition that there were more than 600,000 prophets that prophesied to the Jewish people. Most of the prophecies weren't written down. Only the prophecies that have an eternal message were written down. So when we read these stories, we have to turn to our sages to understand what is the story telling me, what really happened here, and what message am I supposed to take from the story. And bearing that in mind, we are going to get an overview of the next few chapters in Tanakh, and I am purposely going to omit certain details because I want us to first encounter them with the eyes of Chazal. And I request that you don't ask, "Ah, but doesn't it say A, B, and C?" I'm introducing this knowingly. I'm proclaiming at the onset that I will skip certain details, and we'll get back to those details, only we're going to get back to them with debt. So the Navi in the 11th chapter of Shmuel Beis, in the 11th chapter of Shmuel Beis, and being that we paused, so we'll already remind ourselves of a few more details. Firstly, there are burekas back there. Josh, I don't know if you had supper. We brought burekas. And secondly, the breakdown of the prophets into chapters other than Tehillim is really a Christian invention. So when we speak about chapters, we have to know that this is a Christian institution. The same thing, the breaking of Shmuel into Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Beis, Shmuel A and Shmuel B, that's not a Jewish concept. But being that our printers also use this form, so we refer to chapters in Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Beis, so that we can know what we're talking about. So we're holding in Shmuel Beis the 11th chapter. And the Navi tells us we're going to fly through a few prakim now. And again, skipping a few details. The Navi tells us that as the year came to turn, as it was the time the king sent Yoav and his servants and all of the Jewish people went out to battle against Ammon. And they went to the capital and they lay siege on the capital. And David was in Jerusalem. And the first question, and they lay siege on the capital and David was in Jerusalem. And the first question that should bother us is, why are you in Jerusalem, David? You send out your men to fight and you don't fight. In every other war, it seems that David went until he was almost killed and his men said, "We don't want you to go." Until he was almost killed and his men said, "We don't want you to go." So why in this war was David sitting behind and sending all his men out to war? And the evening came and David went to walk on his rooftop and he looked from his rooftop and he saw a woman washing herself. And she was very good looking. "David, what are you doing walking on rooftops? And what's this woman doing washing herself where other people can see her?" So she wasn't. We have a tradition that says there's a big introduction to the story. David was at home. And David recognized with Ruach HaKodesh that the Messiah is supposed to come from him. And that the Messiah is very close and he himself might be the Messiah. And David also recognized that he was given the strength to conquer three nations that God had said would not be conquered until the time of Messiah: Edom, Moab, and Ammon. It happened that in his time, the people of Edom, Moab, and Ammon had waged war with him. He hadn't initiated the war, and he had conquered them. And the Torah says, do not conquer these three nations until the time of the Messiah. They're entitled to their land. And now these three nations attacked him, and by default, he conquered them. So David is standing with the following facts before him. He knows the Messiah can be imminent. It could be a matter of days, weeks, years, and it might be him or from him. And David turns to God and he says, if I'm to be the Messiah, the fourth leg in your throne, so then in the Shmoneh Esrei, I want the Jews to include this fourth concept of Judaism, and they say the God of Abraham, they refer to Chesed, the God of Yitzchak, to Yireh, the God of Yaakov, and then the God of David. And the angels in heaven say, wait a second, the first three were tested, and they lived up to their test in a way that they implemented within the Jewish people the traits that they had acquired. And David has lived up to many tests, but all the tests were private. Every test that David had involved his personal life. His father-in-law was chasing after him, he wanted to kill him. Yes, because he thought he was a threat to the kingdom, but it was a personal threat. All the tests David had were personal. David hasn't yet fulfilled a public test, a test that tests him in his career as king. And the strength, the fourth strength, is the strength of kingdom, of Malchus, and that is what David wanted to bring within the Jewish people, because he thought he was approaching the time of the Mashiach. And so the angels came in heaven and they said, no way, it's not time yet. And David says, he asked God, let's do this. And God says, they've been tested and you haven't been tested. And so David says, test me, God. So God's been tested and you haven't been tested. And so David says, test me, God. So God says, you know what? Not only will I test you, I'll make it easy on you. The three forefathers, I didn't tell them what I would test them. But you, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to test you on, and I'm telling you, you're going to fail. So David said, okay. We have a tradition that when David was standing up to the test, David paused and said, I can do this. I don't have to fail now. But God, if I do this, who's going to win? This can't be in your world that I'm going to be right and you're going to be wrong. So that needs more depth, what that means. That before David sinned, he said, God, I'm doing this for your name. How does that work? Okay, so we're going to leave that right now hanging. David, I don't know if you know this. I'm changing the style of the classes a little bit with you in mind. Really, yeah. Adam. No, a lot of guys. Kabbalah, it says that Adam is an acronym for Adam David Mashiach. The neshama of Adam came to us in Adam, in David, and in Mashiach. And Adam's counterpart, Chava, is going to come back in the form of Bathsheba. We have a tradition that from the time of creation, David was supposed to marry Bathsheba. And when David won Goliath, so he ran up to Goliath and he wanted to chop off Goliath's head. And Goliath had a sheath with a very, very precious sword. The best sword there was. And the sheath had a special lock on it. So David ran up to Goliath. He's lying on his face. And David tries to pull the sword out of the sheath. And he can't. It's locked. So David turns to the lad who had been carrying Goliath's weapons. And that lad tells him, I want to become Jewish. Promise me that you'll get me a Jewish girl if I become Jewish. So David says, you show me how to release the sword, I'll give you a Jewish girl. And in heaven they said, you'll give him a Jewish girl? He's getting your wife. And so Uriah Hachiti, Uriah the Hittite, who was Goliath's carrier of the shield, and who became Jewish after King David overcame Goliath, he got to marry Bathsheba. And Bathsheba in heavens was really meant for David. So now, David takes the sword out of the sheath, kills Goliath and continues with his life. And years later, a young girl gets married to Achiti, and this girl's name is Bathsheba. It's Bathsheba. And Uriah Hachiti. Uriah. And Uriah was one of David's greatest warriors. He was a Ger. He was a Hittite. And had David waited at this point, in heavens it was decreed that Uriah would fall in battle. And a short while later, David would marry Bathsheba. But when David sees Bathsheba, his soul sees potential. Or I'm going to have the Mashiach. And when David sees Bathsheba, David is overcome. He says, that's my soulmate. That's supposed to be my wife. How does that work? Man's on a rooftop, and he just told God, God, test me. And God says, okay. And so now the race is on. David's walking on the rooftop, and the Satan says, I'll get him. So that night, Bathsheba is going up to immerse herself. She is purifying herself from her period, from her nida, which is unusual because Bathsheba was all 6 years old. From here the Gemara derives that in ancient times women were able to have children much earlier. They were, their bodies changed. We know that Cleopatra was all 12, 13, and a world war was fought over her. So we know that people's physical attributes changed. So Bathsheba is immersing herself, and she's not going up to a rooftop to immerse herself. She has surrounding her a little mikveh up there. She has an earthenware encasing. She has like an earthenware mechitzah all around it. So she goes up to Tevel. She goes up to immerse herself. And the Satan says, gotcha, David. And he starts fluttering like a bird. And David sees the bird. And he suddenly decides, hey, I'll catch that bird. He takes out his bow and arrow and shoots at the bird. And then the Satan disappears. And his arrow goes straight into that earthenware mechitzah. Bash. The earthenware falls down. And there's David looking straight down at Bathsheba. David says, wait a second. That's not me. I see such an immodest sight. Can't be. So David says, it must be God's telling me something. It must be she's meant for me. How does that work? So now I'm going to tell you something which, I don't know, it's a Hasidish thought. I think the perspective is more important than whether it's accurate or not. It's important to teach it. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. Someone says it. The thought is as follows. Rashi writes, when describing the ephod, the apron that the Kohen Gadol wore, so Rashi writes, he says, it's an apron like the noble women wear when riding horses. So the Hasidim asks, how did Rashi know what the noble women wore? And they claim that Rashi was once walking down the street and a noble woman rode in a way that he suddenly was startled and he saw her. Because if it were up to him, he wouldn't have seen her. So when Rashi saw her, Rashi said, wait a second, why did God do that to me? I never looked at women. Why did God make it that I have to see her? So when Rashi saw her, Rashi said, wait a second, why did God do that to me? I never looked at women. Why did God make it that I have to see her? Must be because what I saw was that apron. And that must be the sign that that's really as the way the apron is supposed to be in the Mishkan. That's what they want to say. They say there's a story that Yismach Moshe, Hasidish Rebbe, fruits at the fruit stand. So he said, okay, I saw her. The Gemara says you have to see a girl before you marry her. I saw her. She looks okay. I'll marry her. So his parents said, no way. You come from such a respectable family. You're going to marry that girl. So he said, well, I don't want to ever have to look at another girl. I was always careful not to look at any girls. So if God made it that I saw that girl, must be that she's for me. So they went to the Rebbe, and the Yismach Moshe said, this again is on Hasidic tradition, that the Rebbe said, he's right. If this is the level he's maintained his life, so then I bless them that they'll have pious children, and that's what the Hasidim say happened. He married her against his parents' better judgment, and they had very, very pious children. And Hasidim apply this to the story of David. They say that David said the same thing. Why did God do that to me, that I see this girl? I just shot through her mechitza, and now I see something I wouldn't have wanted to see. Must be that she's meant me. That's what Hasidim say. It doesn't say this in the Gemara anywhere. The Gemara says the story about his shooting the arrow. The Gemara says that the Satan tricked him, and he was overtaken, and he had her brought to him. Now, one of the things we can see from here, David's going to err over here. David's going to have a sin. What his sin is exactly, we're going to discuss. We're already going in depth. I meant to get an overview, but okay, we're going in depth already. But we see that he erred. So that means that if there's one message we could walk away from the story, it's that if such a thing happens to a person, he shouldn't say that. Because there was a guy here who was once dating a girl and they broke up. And then I met him a week later and he said, "It's interesting, ever since we broke up, I bump into her every day. Is God trying to tell me something?" I don't know if God's trying to tell him something. I don't know. But I wouldn't be quick to marry the girl just because that happens. Like, we don't know God's signs. We see that David over here made the biggest mess up of his life. Because, according to the Hasidic explanation, because he did this mathematical equation. Because he said, well, if God did this to me, must be there's something meant to happen here. Bottom line, David has her brought to him. And David lives with her, and she goes back home. And a short while later, she lets him know, "I'm pregnant." Now,
and she's like 9 years old.
6 years old. So the Gemara says that if a girl who's 6 years old,
isn't she married?
She's married. She's married to Uriah Hittite, to Uriah the Hittite. But, big but here. When David was younger, so his father instituted within the army an institution that went as follows. When a person went out to war, so his wife is waiting for him to return. Let's say he's a POW. Let's say he's an MIA. He's missing in action. His wife can't remarry. We don't know if he's alive or dead. So in order to ensure that his daughter-in-laws don't get stuck, David's father, Yishai, instituted that every person that went out to war would first write his wife a get. Or sometimes...
David's father was not king.
He wasn't the king, but he instituted it within his family. And when David became king, he instituted it for the whole army. That when a person goes out to war, he writes a get. What kind of get does he write? There are two opinions. There's Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi says that a person who goes out to war, he leaves a get and he writes the following condition in the get. He says, "I am hereby divorcing you, my wife. If I don't come back when all the other soldiers come back from the war, then you are hereby divorced from now." This is to ensure, in case the get gets lost, we don't need the written document. Ordinarily, we say a get, in order to be valid, when it's given over, you have to give over a get. This is Rashi. So Rashi says that what the husband, when he'd leave the war, would give her, he would do the actual giving of the get, and he'd say, "Halachically, from this moment you are divorced from me if I don't come back with the other soldiers. If when everyone else comes back, I don't come back, you're divorced." Rabbeinu Tam, from that moment, not from later. Rabbeinu Tam says that it went differently. The guy would tell her, "I'm divorcing you. No conditions. You are hereby divorced." But they wouldn't do it publicly. Because if everyone knows it, then every soldier, when he leaves, his wife might marry someone else. So they'd keep it a private get between him and her, and he'd leave her a written get without any conditions. But it was with the understanding that if he got back from war, she was to wait for him and he'd marry her. Either way, when David is taking this girl, Bathsheba, according to Rabbeinu Tam, she's divorced. According to Rashi, she may be divorced. She might be married. The Torah teaches us that if a person's wife takes on a vow, so then he may nullify the vow. What happens if she takes on a vow and she says, "I won't shower for the next year"? So he could say, "I don't want a wife that stinks. I'm nullifying that vow now." And from that moment on, it's nullified. What happens if he's walking down the street and his wife takes a vow, "I'm not going to shower"? And his son is a chutzpahdik son. He runs after him and he says, "Dad, Dad, did you hear what mom just said? She took a vow that she's not showering for the next year." So Dad says, "Okay, it's nullified." The wife didn't know that he nullified it, and she goes and takes a shower. So the Torah says she needs atonement. Even though on the books there was no vow, but from her perspective, she was doing an act that was sinful. Even though in truth it wasn't sinful. Let's say a person walks in and he wants to eat some pork. So he goes to the freezer and he takes out a package and he thinks it's pork and he puts it on the fire and he roasts it and he eats it. And then he finds out that it's kosher meat. So we say, even though in essence he did not sin, being that in his mind he wanted to sin and he thought he was sinning, so he needs atonement. He has to repent. The same thing here with David. Right. David is doing an action now. Yeah.
What about the idea that when the has the intention of performing a mitzvah, even though he does not perform the mitzvah, he gets the credit for performing the mitzvah. And one who has the intention to make a chet, and he is prevented from doing the sin, he does not get the intention.
So we say that if a person thought to do a mitzvah but didn't get to do that action, meaning a person wanted to go and visit his parents, to do kibbutz avim, to call them. Suddenly he sees there's no more credits on his phone. So he meant to do it. He just, in the end, he didn't do it. So then we say God treats it as though he actually did it. If one wanted to do an avira, he wanted to turn on a light on Shabbos. And he went and he couldn't find the switch. So he didn't turn on this light. So then we say, God doesn't say, well, you were about to do it, you just couldn't do it. But if one would say, I want to do it, and then flip the switch, and he thinks he's turning on the light, and really it's the Shabbos clock that turns it on, or something like that, so then he would need. But there's more to it than that. That's one understanding. But it's discussed. The question is a good question.
Is that called a doubtful guilt offering?
Oh, so that's an Asham Talui. A doubtful guilt offering. An Asham Talui is what David, in essence, seems to have put himself into the situation which he would be obligated to bring. David put himself into a situation where, according to Rashi at least, when he went with Uriah's wife, Uriah's wife was potentially a free woman, potentially a married woman, depending on if Uriah would come back alive from the battlefield. Now, David was driven, and God had told him, hey, I'm going to put you to a test that's equal. If you live up to this test, this is like you're putting within the Jewish people a whole new trait, and you're not going to live up to it. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov were capable of doing it. You're not. So David, it was already predetermined that David would not live up to this test. It was basically a test which God already told David, I wouldn't give you this test. Ordinarily we say God doesn't put a person into a situation which he can't live up to. But David asked for it. David said, God, test me. So God said, okay, you want it, I'll give it to you, but you won't live up to it.
Why doesn't he just back up then?
Okay. After, no, it's a good point. I don't know what to answer you. What I could tell you is that we have a few psalms in which David discusses this, and in one of them he says, I wish I would have had a muzzle on my mouth. That's what David says. Zamotiv al yavor pi. I wish I had a muzzle on my mouth and the words went across my mouth.
And so he had conversations with Hashem in somehow?
Yeah.
Like a prophet?
But yeah.
Because he made the sin, he had the sin of blood on his hands, so his marriage was building the temple, he building the temple. If he built it, if he wouldn't have had the sin, they would have stood it. Because of Shlomo.
But that doesn't have to do with this. That's a different point.
Well, that's a different point. Everything led to one thing to another because it had to be.
No. That's two different points.
Rav, how can you say she was 6 years old?
Ah, so getting to the fact that she was 6 years old. We work it out from the verses. It's a Gemara. It's not my opinion. Now,
based on the Gemara, it's a fact.
You could do the math about how old her grandfather Achitofel was when he passed away, and how many years passed. You could do the math. She was the daughter of Eliam, who was the son of Achitofel. Her grandfather was Achitofel. Achitofel was one of David's advisors who committed suicide ultimately, who died at a relatively young age. We have the age, I don't remember if it was 30 or 30 something. So we do the math and we know how many years passed between this sin and when Achitofel committed suicide, and you see that it can't be that she was much older. The Gemara does the math. I mean, you could do it yourself.
Achitofel advised his son.
Yeah.
But then his son, he didn't listen to his son and he killed him.
Correct. We'll get to that. So we have a rule. The Gemara says that we know the Torah teaches us that there are two different concepts about a person going with a young girl. One is he takes her forcibly, and the other one is that he seduces her. And the Gemara says that when a child is very young, there's no such concept as seduction. When a child, when she's a child, so then we say seducing a child is equal to rape. There's no difference. So the Gemara says that what King David did here was equal to rape, because she was six, but the Gemara, yeah. Now, why is this of importance? Because the rule is that if a married woman goes with another man, then that other man may not live with her. He may not marry her afterwards. And if a married woman goes with another man, she may not go back to her husband if she does it willingly. If a woman willingly cheats on her husband,
she's killed.
There are witnesses and there's warning, then there's the death penalty. But otherwise, she may not continue living with her husband and she may not marry the man who she cheated with. But here, that's not the case because she was 6 years old. So halachically, what happened here, we don't consider it that she willingly did anything. Even though she did willingly go, David called her in, David said, and David ran the show. We also say that when a king tells a person to do something, we always assume that there's the threat of death behind anything a king tells you to do. Meaning ordinarily we say, Ein shaleach l'dvar avera. If I ask you to go do an avera, so then you can't say, well, he asked me. We say, divrei harav, divrei talmid, divrei mishomim. God told you not to do something, and someone else told you to do it. Well, there's no such thing as you were his messenger. If someone hires a hitman, the hitman can't say, well, I was his messenger. If I send the shaliach to do a different action, I send the shaliach to engage a woman for me, to get married to a woman for me, that's a mitzvah. So then we say you could be a shaliach for that. You do the action and then she's married to me. I can make a shaliach for certain mitzvahs. But I can't make a shaliach for averos. We say when it comes to sin, there's no such concept as shaliach. But what about a king? So a king is different. A king, we say, it's not like you had a choice. If I take your hand and I use your hand to break something, I grab your hand and I forcibly break something. We don't say you broke it. I forcibly took your hand and I did the action. The fact that I used your hand doesn't mean that you did it, I did it. By the same token, if someone puts a gun to your head and says, go do something, so when there's a threat of death, then it's different. Then there is such a concept that, well, he threatened me with death. Of course I did A, B, or C. By the same token, when a king tells someone to do something, so we say there's always the threat of death back in the king. Being that a king could kill anyone, so there's always the threat of the death penalty behind his word. So David's actions here, halachically, are viewed as that he did it forcibly, even though in essence we don't know. Viewed as that he did it forcibly, even though in essence we don't know what went on there. We don't know. But whatever would have happened, regardless, we consider it halachically that she is not forbidden to her husband, should her husband come back alive from the battlefield. Nor is she forbidden on King David.
Wouldn't it be acquiring her through the act of cohabitation? She should not consider married at the time.
If we learn like Rabbeinu Tam.
Wait, why is?
But even that's a good question.
And once she's acquired by someone else,
then she can never go back then. But in order to acquire, it has to be with that intent and with witnesses, etc. There's more to it than just the.
And
living
also
together.
She's six. A lot of times when you're six, if you're not considered.
She's married when her father marries her off. Meaning, the Torah gave the father the ability to protect his daughter from being totally.
Did that happen? In this case?
What? In this case, when Bathsheba was married off to Ittai, to Uriah, so her father married her off.
But, I mean, to David.
And to, once a daughter is married off, then she never goes back to her father's possession.
She's still young enough where she can still say no to that when she gets of age.
That's different. You're confusing two things, but that's not for now. Yeah.
Why is David not, forbidden to be with this girl if he just raped her?
Well,
when a person rapes somebody, then.
Then no. If a woman is taken forcibly by another man, then she is allowed to go back to her husband, and if that husband were to die, she is allowed to, if she wishes, to marry that person. The halacha only forbids, if she wants to, it's her choice. The halacha forbids when she willfully cheated on her husband. Then she's not allowed to marry that person, nor is she allowed to go back to her husband. But if it wasn't at her own will, then she could do whatever she wants. I said that.
What the age?
No, but that's
the
only bit.
Okay.
The ability for the father to do this.
So that referred to our class on it. We discussed it. The fact that a father can marry off his daughter is sometimes in the daughter's best interest, and the Torah meant to protect the daughter.
Practically, what is the explanation that they were mature, they reached puberty stage by a younger age?
Look,
even married already. She was being taken at 6 years old.
Even at even today, we see that the age of puberty keeps going earlier and earlier. In the last 10 years, there's been a marked change. The age of puberty has gone from about 12 to about 9, 10 by girls. Yeah. There's even in the last 10 years, there's been tremendous change. So why is it so far-fetched? I mean, we're already hitting the age of 9 is close to average puberty age today, at least here in Israel, and I think also in the United States. So I know this from the teachers. Like, I heard this from teachers who teach girls. So they know when what's going on. So I don't know.
So we've just touched
the surface, and now we have to go over to our Binyan HaBayit class to be continued. Bezat Hashem, next week.
Why today someone takes a 6-year-old girl, he's like...